This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa القيوم لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه يعلم ما بين أيديه ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء وسع كرسيه السماوات والأرض ولا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A senior Ukrainian official says as many as 13,000 Ukrainian troops have been killed since the start of the war with Russia. The EU agrees on a tentative price cap on Russian seaborne oil. Moscow pledges a supply cut to countries applying the cap. Also in the headlines, British media say people in some cities are eating pet food and using a radiator to heat food due to a worsening cost of living crisis. Our top story this hour, as many as 13,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed since Russia began its war there in February. That's according to a senior advisor to the Ukrainian president. Mykhailo Podolyak says the figure is based on official estimates from the general staff. He says they range from 10,000 to 13,000. The official was speaking with Ukraine's Channel 24. He said President Volodymyr Zelensky will make the official data public at the right time. More than 9 months into the war, neither Russia nor Ukraine has announced the exact figures of their casualties. Both sides are suspected of minimizing their losses to avoid damaging the morale of their troops. In September, Russia said it had lost almost 6,000 troops. Finnish Prime Minister Sanna Marin says the war in Ukraine has exposed both European weaknesses and strategic mistakes in dealing with Russia. Marin made what she called the brutally honest assessment in an interview with an Australian think tank during a visit to the country. She believes Europe is not strong enough right now to stand up to Russia alone. The Finnish Prime Minister is also critical of Europe's policy towards Russia over the past decades. She says the policy aimed to make close economic ties with Russia and buy energy from it to prevent a war, but she added that approach was proved entirely wrong after the conflict began in Ukraine. European Union governments have agreed on a tentative price cap on Russian seaborne oil in an effort to limit Moscow's ability to finance its war in Ukraine. The price cap is set at $60 a barrel and includes a mechanism to keep the cap at 5% below the market price. The decision will take effect on December 5 if it gets approval from all EU governments on Friday. The price cap will be reviewed in mid-January, and after that, every 2 months. That's to assess how it is functioning. The idea was initially promoted by the Group of Seven Nations, also known as the G7. The price cap is to replace a harsher EU outright ban on buying Russian seaborne crude. Russia has already warned that it would stop oil supply to any country applying a price cap on its oil exports. The Italian Parliament has passed the resolution authorizing the government to continue to help Ukraine, including via military aid, throughout 2023. This, as an increasing number of Italians are advocating for peace negotiations to end the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including Centre-Left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kyiv. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance in with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kyiv.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
The British media say the skyrocketing cost of living crisis is pushing people in some regions to eat pet food, while others are trying to heat their food on a radiator. A charity based in Cardiff, the capital city of Wales, says that struggling households do not just appear in areas long associated with poverty. It advised the government that its policy should focus on people, not places. The charity officials say people are not being paid enough to afford the essentials, as the cost of living crisis is pushing prices way up. This comes as official data show the UK inflation has already risen to a 41-year high of above 11%. The government continues to blame the war in Ukraine and the COVID pandemic as the main culprits in the economic downturn. French President Emmanuel Macron has visited the United States with the purpose of boosting ties, but a thorny issue between the two sides has been the Inflation Reduction Act signed by President Biden back earlier this year. France is outraged at how the U.S. is subsidizing its own industries.
France and the United States are considered longtime allies with lots of cultural commonalities. But when it comes to trade, there are signs that the two longtime allies are heading for a confrontation. The French President Emmanuel Macron is visiting the United States on an official visit to boost ties. But during his trip there, Macron had some tough words directed against Washington for what he described as U.S. protectionism for its own industries. Emmanuel Macron is warning that the newly announced U.S. industrial subsidies could split the West. Macron arrived in Washington on Tuesday for his second state visit to the U.S. since taking office in 2017. French officials say Macron will confront President Joe Biden over the subsidies contained in the Inflation Reduction Act. The controversial act was signed by President Joe Biden back in August, and the Biden administration signed that with the Democratic-controlled Congress in a bid to boost U.S. domestic production and create more jobs there.
To a groundbreaking chips and science law that's going to ensure that technologies and jobs of the future are made here in America. In America. And all this progress is part of our vision and plan and determined effort to get the job done for the American people.
Well, things started really well off with Joe Biden. There was a lot of, you know, handshaking and shoulder rubbing, and we're in this together and extremely friendly relations until AUKUS. AUKUS obviously was lived in France like a major betrayal, and it was painful, and nobody tried to hide, you know, how feelings were hurt.
The controversial Inflation Reduction Act allocates billions of dollars to environmentally friendly industries with strong backing for American-made products. But European Union governments are crying foul and threatening to launch a trade war against the U.S. by subsidizing their own green sector.
France is not the only European nation to complain about the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act. Many European leaders have also complained about the legislative package. They say the package unfairly disadvantages non-American companies and would be a serious blow to their economies. The legislation could potentially be disastrous for car makers, especially in Germany and in France. Berlin and France have warned that if Washington does not scale back, they will introduce countermeasures against the United States. European leaders are mulling over the idea of a Buy European Act, just like the Americans. Germany, which is considered the EU's economic powerhouse, has also supported the French calls for more protection for European businesses and manufacturers. There are now talks of countermeasures similar to the U.S. scheme if Washington refuses to address key concerns. Brussels has made it clear that the U.S. legislation to subsidize its own businesses at the expense of its European partners represents a form of economic protectionism that undermines the rules of the World Trade Organization. The controversial act in the Biden administration comes after 4 years of rocky relations between the U.S. and Europe during the tenure of the former President Donald Trump.
Well, during the Trump presidency, the European-American, the French-American relation was quite conflictual and difficult because in the White House was a president who didn't believe in alliance, who undermined NATO every step of the way, even talked about, you know, NATO being obsolete and there was, according to him, a need to move on. He stepped out of the climate agreement on climate. He stepped out of a negotiation on the Iran nuclear program. Everybody remembers that Emmanuel Macron tried to soften somehow Donald Trump, and that it didn't work out.
Furthermore, on the U.S.'s discriminatory policies against the EU are seen as particularly harmful at a time when the world faces an economic slowdown because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Ukraine war, and trade bottlenecks. It is now believed that the U.S. is using the war in Ukraine to its own advantage by imposing its will on the EU.
the first senior officials meeting of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation was held in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad. The meeting was aimed at paving the way for closer cooperation between Islamic countries in the field of science and technology. Iran offered its valuable contribution to the OIC in the meeting. Nasser Kazmi has more.
Pakistan has hosted a dialogue platform for the OIC member states to boost cooperation among them in the field of science and technology. Senior officials representing Iran, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Pakistan attended the meeting, while Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Arab Emirates, and Cameroon participated via video conference. The first senior officials meeting of the OIC Forum was aimed at strengthening scientific cooperation and to encouraging major technological initiatives.
This forum provides us opportunities of bilateral, multilateral cooperation. So one or two or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical, and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister Peyman Salehi told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in near future. Therefore, we arrange for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals, and at the moment we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology parks in Iran, more than 240 incubators, and so on.
Participants in the meeting discussed in detail the objectives, terms of reference, and working procedures of the OIC 15 and recommended them for adoption by the ministerial committee, which is scheduled to be held in the near future.
The presence of Iranian officials in the OIC meeting shows that Iran is not dependent on the East or the West, and it's ready to boost its political and scientific cooperation with various countries across the globe. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
That brings an end to the World Bulletin for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak could back down on his position to ban new onshore wind farms amid a growing Tory rebellion, a cabinet minister has suggested. Business Secretary Grant Shapps denied a challenge on onshore wind farms from Tory rebels constitutes a row, or that there is a massive gulf between their position and that of the government. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Sun has more details. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faces a 100-strong rebellion this week on ripping up wind farm bans and housing targets just a month into office, MPs have warned. The Prime Minister is under pressure from his own cabinet ministers, Michael Gove and Grant Shapps, who are said to be supportive of removing historic bans on onshore wind farms where locals support it. Former Tory chair Jake Berry and COP chief Alok Sharma publicly joined calls to rip up the effective ban in a bid to boost Britain's own energy supply and slash energy bills. Sir Jake Berry, who was sacked from his role by Rishi Sunak, told the BBC, "I think if you want to know why we should have more renewables, just look at your gas or electricity bill." Last night, Downing Street insisted they were unlikely to back the rebel amendment, but were in talks about labelling changes in a bid to see off a furious backlash. Meanwhile, rebels warned they were on track to sign up to 100 MPs to a separate plan to scrap top-down housing targets. Number 10 Downing Street pulled a vote on the bill last week after a row blew up. But last night, former Levelling Up chief Simon Clark warned their dangerous plans risked losing the Tories the next election and destroying the housing market in one fell swoop. Writing in The Sun, Simon Clark said, "When the Conservative Party has been at its most successful, it's because we have put the dream of home ownership at the centre of our offer. Scrapping all targets would kill 100,000 new homes a year. That would not only represent a social and economic tragedy, it will be a disaster for the Conservative Party." Sky News has also covered the same story, giving us more details. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak could back down on his position to ban new onshore wind farms amid a growing Tory rebellion, a cabinet minister has suggested. Former Prime Ministers Boris Johnson and Liz Truss are among some 30 Conservatives backing former Cabinet Secretary Simon Clark's pro-wind amendment to the Levelling Up Bill. Business Secretary Grant Shapps denied the challenge constitutes a row or that there is a massive gulf between the rebels' position and that of the government. The amendment would allow wind farms in rural areas where there is community consent. Grant Shapps suggested this is also the Prime Minister's policy, even though Rishi Sunak vowed to maintain the moratorium on new onshore wind farms during his unsuccessful Tory leadership bid in the summer. Speaking during the leadership campaign, Rishi Sunak said, "Wind energy will be an important part of our strategy, but I want to reassure communities that as Prime Minister, I would scrap plans to relax the ban on onshore wind farms in England, instead focusing on building more turbines offshore." However, Grant Shapps told Sky News, "I've always said that indeed, Rishi Sunak has always said, where onshore wind happens, it needs to happen with local consent. What is being proposed is something which would guarantee that local consent." Grant Shapps admitted he hasn't studied all the ramifications of that in terms of the planning changes. But he added, "To present it as some sort of massive gulf is completely untrue." The business secretary's remarks signal a possible climb down to avoid a damaging defeat by Tory rebels, made more likely by Labour's backing for the amendment. The Labour Party said it is planning to back the amendment to pile the pressure on Prime Minister Sunak, even though the party believes it swaps the ban for what is still a highly restrictive planning regime on onshore wind. Former Conservative Party chairman Sir Jake Berry and Alok Sharma, who was president of the COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, are some of the latest senior Tory MPs to add their names to the legislation. Prime Minister Sunak is also facing a split in opinion within his own cabinet, with Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove understood to be backing an end to the moratorium. Number 10 Downing Street said it would not predict what might happen in the future on onshore wind farms. The Prime Minister's official spokesman told reporters, "You'll know there are quite detailed rules around onshore wind and what is allowed. It requires developers to consult with communities in advance of making a planning application. So I'm not going to predict what might happen in the future." The spokesman said, "The government considers amendments to bills as they are put forward, and that Prime Minister Sunak has talked at great length about his views on where the focus should be on renewable energies." Boris Johnson did not seek to overturn the ban on new onshore wind projects in place since 2015 during his time at Number 10 Downing Street, though Liz Truss said she would relax the rules during her brief administration.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Midstream.
Whatever the identity of those behind the Al-Quds operation, we find that the events of the last week came to dispel the confusion that took place recently about the status of the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank. The double operation of occupied Al-Quds, the first of its kind since 2011, hurt the Zionists and got engraved in their consciousness, just as it warmed the hearts of native Palestinians suffering under brutal occupation. It also honored every Arab and indeed every soul that is free from subordination dipped in humiliation. The double operation, which occurred at two bus stations in Al-Quds about 15 minutes apart, confirmed that there is no place for the Zionists to live in security in the land they illegally occupy, since from every corner they will be targeted by the resistance in ways that may not have yet crossed the mind of the occupiers, who have become helpless in front of the creativity of the courageous people of Palestine. Last week's Al-Quds double operation carried many magnitudes, starting with the manufacture of the actual explosives, which means owning knowledge and ability, in addition to implementation, which means overcoming the occupation's security difficulties. All these factors frustrated the Zionist government and put it in a confused position, unable to do anything. The ultra-Zionists, who are preparing to take over the helm of power after the recent elections, hinted at the option of invading the occupied West Bank. Well, what more can the warden do to fortify his big prison? This warden is helpless in front of the spirit of resistance, which experience from Palestine to Lebanon has proven that it is indeed the spirit that fights, achieving victory and snatching freedom. It is untainted accumulation of resistance work, in quantity and quality, with rising levels of its effective and throbbing movements against both the occupation forces and its illegal colonial settlers, from the folds of the West Bank and its three corners, Jenin, Nablus, and Al-Khalil, into the holy city of Al-Quds, so that the earth explodes with anger under the feet of the temporary entity that began to recall the sore days of the Intifada. Such are qualitative blows in which the resistance in its new form between the West Bank, Al-Quds, and the occupied territories is determined to deliver its appropriate strength to whoever is concerned from the new Zionist coalition that sets settlement expansion projects as its top priority. And so the message was delivered, meaning that the strategy produced by the temporary entities Knesset holding the most dangerous policies of extremism cannot work in the face of the determination of the native people of Palestine, who perfectly know that this world is a word that can only understand force. So how about a force armed with the mother of all rights, the right to liberate Palestine from the river to the sea? Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Israelis are paranoid from the return of the resistance bombings, which had been absent for more than 15 years, but returned to occupied Al-Quds last Wednesday with the implementation of the Al-Quds operation. For many years, Palestinians attacked Israeli occupation forces targets with stabbing, run over, sometimes shootings, and stone throwing operations in response to the Israeli occupation aggressions and human rights violations. But the most effective of all to this moment was the scenes at the bombing sites of the bus stations in the heart of the occupied commercial centers where illegal colonial settlers roam, terrorizing native Palestinians. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashabi, analyst in criminal justice and human rights. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nashabi. Now, the current atmosphere is very tense. The extremist right-wing Zionist voices are rising, and there are also Palestinians calling to escalate operations against the occupation. And this is reflected in the political atmosphere in general. What do you think the effect of such resistance operations, the like of Al-Quds operation, will be on the security of the Zionist forces and the morality of the illegal colonial settlers?
Yes. Well, let's first put things in context. The Israelis have been building and expanding settlements, disregarding any calls to stop this because it's a violation of international law. The expansionist nature of Zionism has been, ongoing. I mean, the European Union, the United Nations have put pressure on the Israelis to stop and to limit their expansion and limit the illegal settlements in the West Bank, but this did not compel the Israelis to stop. The Palestinians are left with no other choice but to continue their armed struggle, their resistance against Israeli continuous violation of international law and of the basic rights of the Palestinian people. This resistance is a clear message. The recent operations are a clear message that there will be no stability, there will be no peace, and no stability as the Israelis continue to build these settlements. And the effect is huge because the effect is that no matter, I mean, this has been going on for so many years, and it will go on for the future, the foreseen future. The Palestinian people will continue to resist this Israeli violent aggression against them and against their basic rights. And that's creating a lot of instability also inside among the Zionists themselves, who are confused on how to react. They want to react violently, but they know that if they react violently, this will not lead to any good outcome for them. This will not stop the resistance. The resistance is going to continue, and it's getting stronger and stronger.
Well, this matter is not considered a huge development only because the operation took place in occupied Al-Quds Square, but also because the operation was carried out with explosive devices detonated from a distance or probably using a stopwatch. This has several implications. I mean, the most important of which is that the resistance in the West Bank now seemingly has the technical and practical capabilities to manufacture such explosive devices. And we've seen how the Lion's Den and other factions of resistance are now just popping up all across the West Bank to resist the occupation. How do you think this development will play out in the event that the Israelis decide to retaliate against the West Bank with a probable incursion?
Well, as I said earlier, I mean, the Palestinians have been resisting Israeli violations and Israeli aggression for so many years. So they accumulated experience, they accumulated know-how, they have developed their skills, and they are getting support from nations who support the resistance, I mean, and parties who support the resistance across the border. Now, the intelligence has been developed, of course. It's not just technology. It's intelligence capacity. It's not just the technology of actually, starting an explosive device from a distance. It's also the intelligence for gathering sufficient information to choose the target, to see where, how to target. And also, I think the explosive material is also becoming more efficient. And this is a very, very interesting development, especially inside the West Bank. And inside the West Bank, there are so many various and different factions among the Palestinians. They are working together. So this is also creating an internal unity among the Palestinians to be able to achieve these operations. And lastly, also the Palestinians have developed this knowledge of how the Israelis function and how they actually gather information about the resistance, and they're able to block them. So this accumulation of experience and knowledge is making the resistance more efficient and actually is targeting more accurately the objectives among the Zionists. And the last operation showed this, and there are hopefully in the future the Palestinian people will continue with these operations and will show even more advanced skills.
What was very interesting was that they were capable of actually maneuvering around the security perimeter of the Zionist entity, especially in a city like the occupied Al-Quds, where
exactly.
Bickering has been forever over whether it is the capital of Palestine or not. Well, we know it is, but the Zionist entity doesn't accept that. How do you think that the security apparatus of the Zionist entity will deal with this breach?
Well, I think they are confused. I don't think that the Israeli security apparatus is being able to handle this situation. They are going through a lot of internal tensions. They don't know how to react. On one hand, there is a current inside among the Israeli enemy that calls for a kind of appeasement and a kind of naturalization of relations with some Gulf countries and Arab countries. On the other side, they are becoming more aggressive. They are lost on how to actually create a balance between these two lines of policy. And that's creating a lot of confusion among the Israelis themselves, whereas the solution is very simple, is to give the Palestinians their basic rights, as the UN and the European Union have been actually saying for so many years. Stop the settlements. The settlements are continue to grow in the West Bank, and that is something that is creating a lot of tension and will create more violence and more instability in the future.
We did hear that the enemy's security assessment have been conflicting about have been issuing conflicting reports about the responsibility of those behind the Al-Quds operation. We had, according to Zionist Channel 7 website, some security assessments indicate that a man from Al-Quds brigades funded by Hamas is responsible. And then we heard from Yari'ot Ahranot, newspaper reported that whoever carried out the bombings acted without external guidance, meaning that he is actually from within the West Bank. Does it make any difference if the West Bank's lines then were behind it, or maybe the resistance factions in Gaza? What's the difference?
Well, it makes a difference, but in both cases, it's bad news for the Israelis. I mean, if this man has been acting alone, I mean, he's more mysterious, he's more unpredictable, more difficult to track, spontaneous, and therefore that cannot be beaten easily, especially for an intelligence apparatus. If that man has been supported by an organization, that shows that how the organizational skills have developed. That means there is a collective kind of an planning, and this is also very bad news for the Israelis. In both cases, this shows that the resistance is ongoing and that there's nothing that will be able to stop it. Israel, that has some of the most advanced technologies in the world, is not able to stop a people asking for their basic rights. And if they're not going to get their basic rights in peaceful ways, they will get it with armed resistance, as the UN Charter, in fact, protects the people who actually struggle for their rights.
For that matter, I do have a solution for the Zionists. Just beat it, get out of Palestine,
exactly.
Liberate Palestine from the river to the sea. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Omar Nashabi, analyst in criminal justice and human rights, for being with us and sharing your insights about the Al-Quds operation. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking how Kurdish separatists in Syria and Iraq are under fire.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the Iranian and Russian positions on the renewed Turkish threat of ground military operations in Syria show a kind of softness that can be explained by a number of new circumstances, which made the three guarantors of the Astana talks intersect in their hostility to the Kurdish separatist forces in northern Syria. This softer approach by Iran and Russia was not until months ago, as it is today, when the Russians and Iranians recorded firmness regarding any Turkish operation of the above-mentioned type. In light of the semi-acceptance of Moscow and Tehran to the Turkish arguments and the trio contacts entering the stage of talking about the limits of the incursion and the political costs required to meet it, Kurdish separatists under fire in this following report.
Under the surface of the calm that the Syrian battlefield experienced throughout the previous months, many pressuring factors were working on more than one active site of the Astana talks, some of which seem to have reached the moment of explosion today. This applies, for example, to the air attacks carried out by Turkey against the Syrian Democratic Forces in northern Syria under the title of Operation Claw Sword, and hinting at the approaching moment of the ground operation during which the Turkish army will control more bordering Syrian land. This step has always been a point of discussion throughout the past period, especially in the Astana round of talks held last June and then again last week on November 23, which took place 2 days before the Turkish bombing of the SDF sites in full view of the Russian and American forces deployed in the region. And while Russia is still on its declared position rejecting the Turkish ground move, with the emergence of noticeable changes in the field in terms of allowing Turkish planes to penetrate Russian airspace inside Syria, Iran these days is showing greater understanding of this move. For Russia, the Russian-Turkish cooperation has reached its climax in recent months with the intensification of the Russian special operation in Ukraine, as Russia realizes that Turkey today is one of its main crossings to the world in light of the ongoing Western blockade on the former. As for Iran, which is dealing today with Western-instigated internal unrest, it accuses the Kurdish opposition party stationed in the Kurdistan region of northern Iraq of being responsible for sending, training, and equipping armed groups to carry out terrorist acts on Iran's soil. Iran responded quickly to this threat by targeting the sites of these parties, also hinting at the possibility of launching a ground military operation to remove them from its borders with Iraq. Hence, Turkish diplomats argue in front of their Iranian counterparts in the context of the formation of the new Iranian position towards the armed Kurdish parties, comparing it with the previous and current Turkish position, to say that their country's past and expected military operations in Syria are legitimate and justified. Met by this argument, Iranian officials show understanding of Turkish security concerns, but they did urge their Turkish counterparts to cooperate with the Syrian government to ensure the deployment of the Syrian army on the borders between the two countries in order to prevent Kurdish military operations inside Turkish territory. This is exactly what Tehran sought with Baghdad, the first fruits of which were evident in the Iraqi government's announcement of the deployment of its forces on the borders between Iran and the Iraqi Kurdistan region. Thus, it appears that the interest of the three guarantor countries of the Astana talks converges with hostility to the Kurdish separatist forces in northern Syria.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Mr. Aqil Hananu, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Aqil. Now, what made the three guarantors of the Astana talks intersect in their hostility to the Kurdish separatist forces in northern Syria?
I think this is the beginning of the end for the hostility going on in Syria. I think this is a message to the American more than the Kurds. The Kurds are tools used by the American. We never heard about the American caring about the Kurds or Syria or anybody before now. And the continuous support of the American to the Kurds for their aggression, for their stealing of the oils and the wheats of Syria. And then now the accusation of the bombing in Istanbul
caused all this. At the same time, in Iran, the Kurds in Iran also start moving, trying to repeat the story of Syria, which consolidated the three alliance between Turkey, Iran, and Russia. And I guarantee you, what's going on in the northern part of Syria right now, it's happening with the complete approval of the Syrian government. Because at one point, the Turks asked the Syrian Arab Army to control the Kurds, and the Syrian government refused to participate in any war over there as long as the occupation forces of Turkey remain in there. So that forced the hand of Turkey to come and clear the area and as a sign of beginning to go to normalization between Syria and Turkey.
Well, Musaqil, under the surface of the calm that the Syrian battlefield has experienced, especially throughout the previous months, many pressure factors were working on more than one active party in the file of the Kurdish separatists, some of which seem to have reached a moment of explosion, as you mentioned when you started. However, wouldn't that just allow a reignition of dormant terrorist organizations in Syria, like, for example, al-Nusra or Daesh, in the event that Turkey actually gets inside of the Syrian territory?
Well, the Turkish are already inside the Syrian territories, and the Turkish are part of the protectors of Daesh and Nusra. Daesh and al-Nusra, they are not independent organization where they could move as they wish. They wait for instruction, and they act on those instructions from their masters. So I don't think there will be any movement from Daesh or al-Nusra at this time, because the Turkish don't want to create another battle. They want to finish from the Kurd separatists in Syria, and then they will focus on al-Nusra and Daesh. And that battle is coming. It's not something is going to be put off for a long time. Once the Kurds get contained, the next target will be Idlib, where al-Nusra is based.
But what's the guarantee that the Kurds will be contained? I mean, we all watched 2 weeks ago the Istiklal bombing in the heart of Istanbul, and we still don't have answers if actually the Kurds had a hand in it or not. But what is the guarantee for Turkey that the Kurds of Syria will be contained?
Well, that's the guarantee. It's going to come from the United States. When you cut off the supply and the support of the American to the Kurds, they have no way but to go back to the bases and try to consolidate whatever problem they have with the Syrian government. I mean, the Russian has suggested that the Syrian army protect the border and for the Kurds to withdraw. But the Kurds refuse, and that's also according to the instruction they received from the American. So we are waiting to see, and I think those people are not going to be settled with peace negotiation, because any peace negotiation with them will give them legitimacy, which they should not have, because they do not have it. So the guarantee is going to come from their master, mm-hmm. and what I see with the American are trying to position themselves to clear the area in the Middle East from any hostility so they could focus on China and Russia.
Well, we did see that Russia is still on its declared position, rejecting any Turkish incursion into Syria. But we did see some noticeable changes. For example, the Russians are now allowing the Turks to use the airspace that they protect over Syrian territory. And we did see also Iran these days showing greater understanding of any possible incursion by the Turks. Might we see a joint Turkish-Iranian attack against Kurdish pockets, both in northern Iraq and in northern Syria?
In Iraq, for Iran, I do anticipate some kind of movement, unless the Iraqi government comes and control the area there. But I do not anticipate to see any Iranian armed forces in Syria. Syrian army are capable, and the Syrian army has the same goal as the allies, Russia and Iran, in Syria. And the incursion of the Turkish into the space protected by Russia has been approved by the Syrian government for the goal of that intervention to end the separatist Kurds' presence in the northern part. So I don't see any military presence of the Iranian in Syria, be it airspace or ground.
Well, in less than a minute, can you tell me what the position of the Syrian government will be from all of that we mentioned?
Well, the Syrian government wants to liberate all its property and land. And that's the goal. Who does it doesn't matter. But whoever left standing after this, the Syrian army will take care of it. We will spread our authority over all the Syrian land. And listen, before all this Arab Spring or the revolution, democracy, none of Turkey or Iran had any problem with any Kurds or anybody, because the Syrian army was controlling their land. The Iraqi army was controlling their land. But when the American came with the presenting democracy and freedom as they see it into this part of the world, chaos erupted, and here we are now.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Aqil Hanan, a political commentator, joining us from Atlanta, Georgia, to talk about how the separatist Kurds, both in Syria and Iraq, will see the end of these days to come, especially at the beginning of next year. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you for being always part of our reports of telling the truth. Sanction us no matter how you see possible. We will never cease telling the truth. I'll see you again next week. Salam alaikum.
In the limelight.
A million species of plants and animals face extinction today. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote, in 2014, as temperatures topped 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit in eastern Australia, half of the region's black flying fox population perished, with thousands of the bats succumbing to the heat in one day. This die-off is only one example of the catastrophic loss of wildlife unfolding globally. On average, wildlife populations tracked by scientists shrank by nearly 70% between 1970 and 2018. A recent assessment by BWWF and Zoological Society of London found, when wildlife populations decline to this degree, it means dramatic changes are impacting their habitats and the food and water they rely on. WWF chief scientist Rebecca Shah said in a statement, adding, "We should care deeply about the unraveling of natural systems because these same resources sustain human life." WWF's Living Planet Report 2022, launched this October, analyzed populations of mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and fish. It's not a census of all wildlife, but reports how wildlife populations have changed in size, the authors of the report wrote. A million species of plants and animals face extinction today, according to a landmark 2019 report from the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, an international scientific body. The new analysis uncovers another aspect of this biodiversity crisis. The decline of wild populations doesn't just translate into species loss, but can also heighten extinction risk, particularly for endemic species found only in one location. Instead of looking at individual species, the Living Planet Index, LPI, on which the report is based, tracks 31,000 distinct populations of around 5,000 species If humans were considered, for example, it would look like tracking the demographics of countries. Population declines in one country could indicate a localized threat like a famine, but it was happening across continents. That would be cause for alarm. The steepest suspicious declines occurred in Latin America and the Caribbean, where wildlife abundance dropped by 94% on average. In this region, freshwater fish, reptiles, and amphibians were the worst affected. Freshwater organisms are at very high risk from human activities worldwide.